Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Welcome to The Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I'm about to deliver 40 minutes of total football right into your ears. That's kind of kinky, isn't it? But I can't do it on my own, so it's a good job that I'm joined by Paddy Barkley, Ben Smith, and broadcasting from his secret bat cave in lovely Rippendon, it's Ollie Kay. Later on, I'll be asking my panel if a player who suffers racial abuse from an opponent on a football pitch is duty-bound to report it. But first, we start at Stamford Bridge. Right, Chelsea and Liverpool. Paddy, I'm going to begin with you. Yeah. I was struck by this Liverpool lineup. I know we'll get stuck into Chelsea, but I looked at it and I sort of thought to myself, all right, you know, this is kind of where Dalglish kind of earns his penny. He's not afraid to go and change things around. I certainly wasn't expecting Maxi and Downing on the bench and Henderson on the bench. Carroll on the bench we're kind of getting used to. Mm. What did you make of it? I mean, is it a case of Dalglish really sort of tweaking and tailoring things to the opposition?
Yeah, I definitely think so. They will have, I would say, Steve Clarke probably designed the team, but Dalglish's assistant and, of course, the former Chelsea stalwart. He'd obviously looked at Chelsea, looked at the way they defend deep and without any method. And, I mean, the pressure was ferocious. I mean, for me, the highlight of the match was an incident just before the first goal. Before Liverpool took the lead, where Chelsea got penned in the corner of the field where the visiting fans sit, you know, to the left of the main stand there. And, I mean, Chelsea did everything to work the ball out. And eventually, I mean, every time they tried to turn, there was a Liverpool player on them. And it was wonderful. I love watching that kind of pressing in that kind of area. And eventually, I think it was Ramirez just thought, you know, I just got to give away a throw in here. And it was a great roar from the Liverpool fans. And you thought, yeah, they've got him by the throat. And sure enough, they scored 30 seconds later because Cech, you know, Cech got a lot of the blame. But, I mean, Mikel trying to turn in a situation like that was just deplorable. And Liverpool then scored, you know, one of those goals that coaches love, you know. Win it as high and do-do in the net. It was Barcelona football. And anyway, that for me showed all that was right about Liverpool and all that's hideously wrong about Chelsea.
Ollie, you're closer to Anfield than the rest of us. Did you see this lineup coming?
With hindsight, yes. I think as soon as the lineups landed in the press box yesterday afternoon, I think everybody was saying that is the team to take on Chelsea. If you get enough of the ball, and if you can get it into those forward areas enough, then that front forward Liverpool had, Count Rodriguez, Bellamy, Suarez, was certain to cause Terry and Louis problems, because they're quick, they're tricky, they're clever in their movement, they'll drag people this way and that, and that's exactly what they did. It reminded me in some ways of the way Ferguson approached the Champions League ties against Chelsea last season. When I looked at that and I thought, God, does he know what he's doing here? going 4-4-2 against Chelsea? Aren't you going to be outnumbered in central midfield? And the key to it is not being, you know, he's competing well in midfield, he's standing your ground, passing the ball intelligently when you've got it, and just causing havoc when you go forward. Because that Chelsea back four, I mean, we've been saying for, you know, for as long as for most of the past decade, Chelsea have always had a really good defence. Yet the last 18 months or so, it's creaked horribly, and never more so than in the last two home games against Arsenal and Liverpool.
And I think also, you know, you have to look at a defensive structure that. If what's very important is what's in front of the back four. Yeah, I know Luis is a joke, but it's what's in front of the back four that's the problem. Ramirez can't really play, and Mikel is an absolute disaster. I would say he's one of the weakest players in the Premier League. And, you know, this is the club, after all, that defined, thanks to Real Madrid, the defensive midfield player role. You know, the Makaleli position, they call it to this day.
I'd argue they call it that in England. And let's be very clear on this. People have thought of having a defensive specialist in front of the back four years before, as you know, Paddy. Yes. But
I'm aware of that. But you know what I mean. The Makaleli is probably the best. You won't find a better example of a defensive, so-called defensive midfield player than Claude Makélélé. And this is a position that Chelsea have... Arsenal haven't filled it since Gilberto Silva. It's the most underrated position in the game since, you know, people recognise the value of fullbacks. So Chelsea have simply got to get Romeo, the guy they've got from Barcelona, is far and away the best choice they've got. He didn't play yesterday, unfortunately, should have done. But they have to find a player through whom they can play the ball out, and Romeo certainly got more chance than either of the two that they used. Admittedly, they had the sense to take Mikel off at half time, and thereafter things improved radically.
Ben, is Paddy being a little bit harsh on Mikel and Romeo? I mean, we're talking about a Chelsea team that won the double 2 years ago and that finished second in the Premier League last year, despite injuries and despite, you know, the sort of the manager knowing his season was over come March. Is Paddy going to slightly talk? Are you going to stick up with it, or are you going to join Paddy in the crucifixion of Messrs. Ramirez and Mikel?
I think Chelsea's problems go far deeper than one player at the moment. I think Mikel is a problem, and it hasn't looked like the player we thought he was going to be for some time now. And I think that is an issue for Chelsea, but I think their problems run deeper than that. I think you look at the back four, the communication between the centre-backs has been a real problem this year. David Luiz yesterday, much has been said and written about it already, but the communication between him and John Terry was woeful. I mean, at some points there just wasn't any, and Luiz was off playing offside and Terry was back. There was no look or glance or word to say, come on, here we go, chaps, you know. I think that
Ashley Cole getting nutmegged by Glenn Johnson and Jordan Henderson twice in the space of 2 minutes.
I think,
when's the last time that happened?
Well, exactly. I think unless you have that solid foundation, those three players at the back, the two centre halves, and your holding midfielder, you're in a real, you know, you're in a bind from the start. I think Mourinho's Chelsea had that nailed down. You had Cavallo, Terry, Makélélé, and then on those three players.
Why does it go back to Mourinho's Chelsea? There have been managers since then.
But I'm talking about defensive stability, and you look at that for the example, and all of a sudden Chelsea don't have that.
Cavallo was properly replaced by Alex, but you know, for one reason or another, he became unavailable through injury and playing for another club. So it's. Basically, you cannot afford a player like Luis. He's got an immense ability, but I haven't the faintest idea where he could play.
No, I agree.
He couldn't play holding midfield player because he's not responsible. He doesn't want to defend.
Two things I want to chuck at you. First of all, on David Luiz, he played for Brazil over the break recently and wasn't marauding, sat there, played very well, was very disciplined. At some point, when you see such a disparity, you know, between a performance in one context for a player and performance at club level, do you start to maybe question the manager and the people who are coaching them when it's the exact same guy? And secondly, on John Terry, it seems to me, and somebody else has pointed this out, that the kind of mistakes he's making are the kind of mistakes that you're actually not supposed to make as you get older. Mistakes to do with positioning, perhaps, with reading of the game, and so on. does that strike you as strange?
I think if you look at Terry, I mean, his performance, his form over the last 18 months or so has been a lot poorer, and I think an awful lot of that comes down to, I mean, obviously there's the fact that he's getting older, and people might look at that as the obvious thing, or they might think, oh well, he's had such a lot going on with his life, he's clearly distracted. I think the big issue with Terry is the fact that he has never been as comfortable as he was when he had Carvalho alongside him. I think Carvalho was one of the most underrated players that we've had in English football in the last 10, 20 years. It's just a fantastic reader of the game. And at that time, that was exactly what Terry needed to have alongside him. If you look at Terry now, he's a little bit slower. He's maybe not able to get all over the pitch, get his head, get his feet and body in the way of everything. It's almost like the Jamie Carragher thing. He almost needs his partner now to be able to do what he used to do. He needs to have a dominant and yet impeccable partner, and he's got none of those things in Luis.
I want to turn the subject a little bit to Andre Villas-Boas, because you know he came out after the game and he said, well, you know, they paid $15 million for my services and they're paying me a lot of money. It would cost them, you know, a huge amount to sack me, so I'm sure I'll be given time. And you appreciate he's trying to do things differently and whatever else, but the fact of the matter is I don't think that they've lost two consecutive home games since Ranieri. I think this is the worst start of the Abramovich era. And if you compare it to his predecessor, it's basically it's the same group of players plus, you know, plus all the spending that they did in the summer, many of those guys that he brought in. Paddy, how much of an excuse are you, how much leeway should we be giving Villas-Boas in the media, and how much leeway should Abramovich be giving him?
Oh, well, I mean, I think if the comparison with Liverpool is there, you know. I mean, Dalglish has had a year nearly at Liverpool. He's made such a stark improvement. I mean, but on the morning of the match, we were saying, God, this is going to be interesting. You know, Liverpool have been dropped 8 points in 6 home games. You know, are they in trouble? You know, what this game told us, you know, one of these teams had to stand up, and it was Liverpool. But Villas-Boas needs those extra months that Dalglish has had. And I just think it, of course, we have to judge them now. But, you know, he doesn't like using the word transition, but I'm not afraid to. They are a team in transition. Everyone has known that. For the last 5-6 years, people have been saying it's an ageing squad. And of course, even though you keep buying younger players, all the other ones get a year older. I mean, Lampard was significantly... They needed a performance from Lampard yesterday. Didn't get it. But we've discussed Terry. You know, this is a...
So you're not blaming the manager, basically. You're saying
no,
it's a transition season and so on. And
I think he's trying to balance so many things. He's trying to rejuvenate the team. He's trying to change the style because he was partly brought, I would guess, by Abramovich because Porto played with such an attacking style of football under him. And
well, it's not like Chelsea were a defensive team before.
I think it's sort of been well leaked that that Abramovich wants a team that wins with some adventure and some swagger. So
play David Luiz at the back. You'll get no, but I mean, this is the part I don't get about the manager. About the owner. And to me, all I want to hear from you on this as well, because this is where I put it on Roman Abramovich's shoulders. So you bring in Ancelotti and you say, we want to win the Champions League, we want to win now with these players because it's financial fair play and whatever else. And okay, you win the double and then you finish second the other year, you don't win the Champions League, and then you don't like him anymore and you're going to rip up the blueprint and you're going to go in a different direction. That's fine. And so, first of all, you don't actually make that decision to commit to Villas-Boas until the end of June because you spend all this time messing around with Goose Hiddink or whoever you're messing around with. But once you've committed to Villas-Boas, you have to give him the tools. Ollie, I look at this team, and all the old guys are still there. These are old guys. They could have bought their contracts out. They could have moved them on. You've got very talented young players like Lukaku, Josh McEachran, who aren't going to get on the pitch. If you're transitioning, you know, you got these guys there. You either send them out on loan or you use them. It makes no sense to have them sit, you know, act as tackling dummies in training. Am I wrong here, Ollie?
No, you're absolutely right. And it's indicative of everything that has characterised the last few years at Chelsea. There's no, I mean, I've said this so many times, but there's no direction, no leadership, no strategy, there's no idea, there's no vision, there's no philosophy.
Should he sack the chief executive then? Well, if you're Abramovich, who can you sack to fix it?
I mean, the chief executive's done a pretty lousy job in making himself sufficient, hasn't he? But I don't think he really has any power. It all goes on the whims of Abramovich. Whether it's
give me somebody to sack. I'm Abramovich. Well, I want to sack somebody.
No, it's not a case of sack someone.
If I can't
someone.
Sack Villas-Boas, I got to get rid of somebody, right?
I wouldn't sack Villas-Boas, but I wouldn't necessarily have appointed him in the first place for that particular challenge. And I think if you go back to the summer, I think people thought, God, that's a bit risky. A guy who's managed for a season and a half going into a job like that, which is going to be a huge job in terms of man management, personalities, everything, and changing an entire team. But it's not really a case of sacking anyone. Why hasn't Abramovich got any football brain around him? He used to have Frank Arnesen, who I know people will look at the kids that he signed and say, well, that, you know, they ended up no good, but he was at least a football person. Instead, he's got Michael Emanalo as his technical director, who's basically another buddy of Avram Grant.
Ollie, though, you said no football people. I mean, you may not like Emanalo, but he is a football person, right? And also, I got to take it, you don't buy the fact that Goose Hiddink has been Roman Abramovich's muse lurking in the shadows and whispering sweet nothings in his ears all those years?
No, I think Hiddink has been consulted, but I don't think he's been heavily involved in strategy. But the point is that there is no one around Abramovich that says, look, this isn't a good idea. Why don't you think of this? I've got respect for what Abramovich has done in terms of changing Chelsea as a club, but the last 5 years, I think the decisions he's made have turned a position of incredible potential. I think Chelsea have been a failure the last 5 years. You can say that they've reached so many Champions League semi-finals, etc., runners-up however many times in the Premier League, but I think the whole thing just the way Chelsea have gone, the whole awkwardness, instability of this transitional period, the uncertain future, it reflects awfully on Abramovich's judgment and grasp of football.
Ben, I'm going to give you the final word. Maybe you'll remind Ollie that Chelsea also did win the double, not 100 years ago, but just two seasons back.
I think this issue goes to the very heart of the problems at Chelsea. You can't have transition at Chelsea in some ways because the pressure to win is always there. But if you do sack Ancelotti, which I don't think was the right decision, and you employ a 33-year-old manager, you have to give him time. By the very nature of employing a 33-year-old manager, come what may this season, they have to allow him to rebuild this side. Simple as that.
Guys, I'm going to leave you with one incredible thought here. We've spent all this time talking about Chelsea and Liverpool. We haven't mentioned Fernando Torres once. Torres, of course, came on, I think, for the last 8 or 9 minutes in that game. I don't know if it means that he's transitioned into irrelevance at this stage, or whether nobody thought fit to question his exclusion, maybe we should need to get used to it. But one thing's clear to me, at least, he's got a long way back. You know, every week I sit and I pick two games to talk about in our Premier League review, and I always get accused of overlooking the little ones. So this week we're going to do a little change. Let's talk some Wigan, let's talk some Blackburn here in a game that was very eventful. Let's get this out of the way, because I don't want to just make it seem like it's a big freak show and Venky's and Keane and all this stuff. The corner kick, for those who didn't see this, Yakubu goes up, puts the ball down with his hand, and then walks away from it. Pedersen, perhaps thinking that Yakubu had touched the ball, and so the ball was in play, perhaps just flat-out cheating, just takes the ball and runs with it, which is obviously illegal. You're not allowed to do that. And then he crosses the ball, and I believe it was Hoylett putting the ball in the net. I don't know what more we can say about this, but I am curious about one thing. If Yakubu had touched it, would we be giving points for being clever, or would we be calling it a bit of a lack of sportsmanship? Paddy?
No, I think we would have been calling him clever.
Deception?
Craftsmanship, you know, craftiness. I don't mind any of that at all. But I just think it's one of those things. Yes, it was technically wrong, but do we want referees like Andre Mariner looking for, you know, it's the mood of one of the curses of the time, the second guessing. I want my referee doing what Mariner was doing, which is concentrating on sorting out the impeding in the box. You know, until we get the two extra officials that Platini likes so much, the referee's always going to have to do that rather than look at million to one chances out on the corner flag. I don't think it technically really desperately matters either. It's just one of those quirky, rather enjoyable things.
It's a strange one. United scored a goal, I think Ronaldo scored it a few seasons back, which in a very similar situation that was ruled out. And the rule has recently changed from the ball having to travel over its circumference, because apparently referees were finding it difficult to judge whether the ball had rolled over a circumference or not, to the ball has to just move, which is actually far harder to see, I think. And that is obviously, I mean, I don't think there's any debate that Yakubu did touch it, because I think he said himself he didn't. But if Mariner hasn't seen it, and his back is turned, and as Paddy said, he's looking at what's going on in the penalty area. If he hasn't seen it and he's not sure, then I don't think he can allow the goal.
I'll tell you one thing.
Ollie, you live closer to qualified referees than we do. Here's what I don't understand, right? So I'm assuming the assistant referee was on the opposite side of the pitch, so that's fine. He's got to look through a whole, you know, forest of players. But the referee on this side, I'm assuming, is up by the halfway line and has a completely unimpeded visual down to the corner flag. Now, I realize it's far away, but he can actually see what is happening, right? Yeah. Should he have picked it up? Or, in fact, let me go even further. Should we look at the rules and just not have him stand a million miles away in his own half and actually, on corner kicks, have him come down and help out a little?
Well, I don't think linesmen are generally athletic enough.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
To react to the counter attack and sprint 80 yards in 10 seconds or whatever if they need to. But I think, is this not an issue where Michel Platini's fourth and fifth officials could be useful? I know they get a bad press and people say, what's the point of them? But I mean, they could keep an eye on that kind of thing. And there are their brief is to intervene when invited to by the referee rather than to intervene constantly. So I mean, I think that's the kind of area where they could get involved. But I also ended up thinking after this goal was that what's wrong with a guy dribbling in from the corner flag, taking a quick corner kick that way? I mean, it's
many very silly. I mean, somebody needs to go through the laws of football. I mean, it was done about 10 or 12 years ago. It wasn't done very well. Going through the laws of football and working out what do we need these things for. I mean, the other one is, why does the ball have to be at a standstill when you take a free kick? I mean, you should be able to volley a free kick if you're clever enough. I mean, the thing is, anything that gives an advantage to the attacking side, and a moving free kick, a dribbling corner, anything like that should be encouraged, not proscribed.
What about throw-ins? You could have some guy who can shot putter and everybody would be Roy Delap.
Yeah, the problem.
You could shoot straight on goal. Wouldn't that be exciting?
Allowing throw-ins to be taken by the foot is
I'm not saying by the foot, just with the hand, like the way goalkeepers do it when they chuck the ball up the pitch.
Yeah.
You're okay with that?
I think that needs a bit more thinking about. But we certainly need a proper, intelligent reappraisal of the laws, which I think are at the moment are far too negative.
Right, back to the game itself. This whole thing turned late in the game. I mean, Paul Robinson made some fantastic saves. Late in the game, he's up for a corner kick, and James MacArthur goes out and basically karate kicks him in the head. I don't know if it was maybe like, you know how like some animals like have difficulty spotting colors, and obviously Robinson's jersey different from the other Blackburn players, so he doesn't see him. Mm. I was just absolutely shocked because he could have really removed his head. Mm. That then leads to the penalty, which leads to the equalizer. And it was funny because I got some tweets from some friends who are Blackburn supporters, and they were like, oh no, Steve Keane is going to spin this as to talk about his spirit, and now we're stuck with him for another week. Ollie, you're up there in lovely Lancashire, sort of. Is the anti-Keane camp now so big that they actually maybe wanted Rovers to lose so they could get rid of this guy?
Well, they might look at it and think that a point really doesn't really make a great deal of difference to the bigger picture. I mean, there is undoubtedly an awful lot of hostility to Steve Keane, and people look at it and think, well, this just isn't working. They sacked Allardyce on the evidence of three or four games, which included the odd win. Why are they sticking with this guy after, what is it, I mean, it's nearly a year, and they've won something like six games in 2011, something like that. But, I mean, I do agree with Keane when he talks about the performances. The performances aren't really that bad. They deserve to be in a better position than they are, but I just think they're one of these teams that seems to be sort of shrouded in negativity, and sometimes that becomes a bigger issue than the competence of the manager itself. It becomes defined by the negativity, this sort of dark cloud that hangs over a club, and the manager either does or doesn't have the ability and energy and motivational powers and so on to lift it. And it seems like one of those situations, rather than one that where you're saying this guy is clueless. You look at the performance and say, well, he's actually doing something right. The players still respond to him. The players are still playing for him. But it just looks like one where the mood around, you know, the supporter supporter to management mood becomes so dark and so damaging that you think change might over time become inevitable.
Okay, our debate this week, we're not going to debate what Sepp Blatter said unless somebody feels very, very strongly that Sepp Blatter was 100% correct and that there is no problem whatsoever with racism in football, and that if you are racially abused by an opponent, you should simply shake hands, apologize, and let him off. Turn the other cheek because it worked for Jesus Christ. Does anybody share that viewpoint?
No.
Good. So now we can move on. Ollie, On the issue of whether, I want to get your take on this point about whether a player who is racially abused is obliged to step forward if nobody else heard the abuse, if it's just him and his accuser. Does he need to step forward? Or could there be a situation where, for whatever reason, he would rather not? Maybe because he said horrible things about the other person, maybe because he tried to injure him, whatever the case may be, maybe because he doesn't want to get the other person in trouble.
Well, I mean, this argument has come up with the Anton Ferdinand issue, where people have, well, the odd Chelsea fan has said to me on Twitter, oh, well, did you not see Anton Ferdinand, did you not hear that Anton Ferdinand said something outrageous about John Terry's private life? Now, given that John Terry, allegedly, is perpetrator rather than victim of those things, I would say that's almost, I mean, it's sledging to use the cricket term, but I would say that's more fair game than abusing a guy, whether John Terry did it or not, over the cover of his skin. It is not the same thing. Anton Ferdinand, if he said something to John Terry, might have felt a bit queasy about the idea of going to the FA or going to the police or whatever, but he needn't do because racial abuse, if it happened, and if it happened in the Suarez ever case, is on a completely different scale. It's horrific. It's abominable. It's everything like that. And as to whether people have an obligation or a obligation to remain silent or whatever, we live in football is a game now where people lie about everything in order to get other people in trouble on the pitch. People will pretend they've been hit in the face, pretend they've been, pretend they haven't touched a ball or they'll dive or whatever, to think that there's some kind of moral code to keep racism and racial abuse quiet is nonsensical. I'd much rather we had an honest game in which something as serious as that was considered so outrageous that people automatically went to the authorities and could be believed.
Let me make this. I'm going to try this again because this was made very clear. And maybe it's my fault for not explaining this properly. This is made very clear to me by somebody around Sepp Blatter about what he was driving at, and it is this. Okay, imagine there is a scenario where a black player goes and tries to break somebody's leg. Or does so, and the aggrieved comes out with a racial epithet in anger back at it. Mm. Imagine there's a scenario. I mean, this happened to I don't want to name who it was, but as an England player a few years ago who told me that he once, and he felt horrible afterwards, but he abused another player. They were getting into it with each other, but for mocking the fact that the kid had just had a kid's wife had just had a baby, or partner had just had a baby that was born with major birth defects, and then it died. Mm. Right, so you hear these things. There's horrible things that can be said in that scenario. If it's something that's clearly said that in that scenario, if there's racial abuse with it, is it imperative that the player must the player come forward if the player does not want to come forward? And I think we can all think of at least one case where a player was racially abused and didn't want to come forward because he felt that he dished out just as bad, he dished out abuse that was just as bad. I'm not talking about Ferdinand and Terry. I'm not saying specific. This was Blatter's point. I think in theory, there should be a situation like that. And if you can resolve it amongst yourselves, that's better than having people lip read cameras from a distance and things like that. And I don't know exactly how I feel about Blatter's point, but I just wanted to get that across and maybe didn't explain it properly. Ben?
I take your point on that. I can see why...
Blatter's point.
Yeah. I can see the clarification there. And I can see why... if a player who has been racially abused doesn't feel that he wants to report it, then perhaps we shouldn't be forcing that player into doing it. But that in some way excuses, in my view, racial abuse. It allows it to happen and to go unpunished. And I feel very uncomfortable about that idea that whatever is said to someone to provoke them, racially abusing someone in response can never be acceptable. And even if that player is not comfortable with going ahead and taking that on and saying, I want to prosecute this guy because he said this, this, and this, I think to allow it in our game, is simply wrong. I don't think it can ever be excused. And so,
would you punish a black player who is racially abused and doesn't come forward?
Would I punish a black player who is racially abused and doesn't? No, not at all, no.
Well, I mean, don't we have laws in this country where if you're party to a crime and you don't report it?
No, I think if you...
I mean, if you take it to the next level, isn't that...
But I think if you walk down the street from here and someone punches you in the face and you don't want to go to the police to report them, then no, you know, I don't think anyone's going to come and say...
But if a player on the pitch gets racially...
But I think you have to draw the analogy with, for example, a woman who's the victim of domestic violence. If her husband is finally brought to book by a third party, he and she should not be tried, he for the actual violence and she for not reporting
I think
that there should be an obligation, but I don't think there should be punishment for someone who succumbs. You know,
absolutely. But I think to allow it in any form, even if the player himself doesn't want to come forward, I think to allow it to happen in any form, if we are able to prove, which is very, very difficult as we found, that it has taken place, then we have to punish it. As Paddy says, it can't be allowed in any form.
I also said I'd like to qualify, if this doesn't sound odd, I'd like to qualify the phrase zero tolerance. The incident you outlined, in which a player had his leg deliberately broken, thank God, you know, I'd like to think this is mythological or apocryphal. Utters as part of his response something that that is racist. I think the circumstances should be taken into account. Yes,
Ollie.
I mean, if a guy had his leg broken, yes, he's the victim. But if he responds to that with racial abuse rather than abuse, then that is a crime itself, isn't it? A crime of passion or whatever you'd call it. You know, it's. I could understand anger, but if we're moving towards zero tolerance of racism, it has to be zero tolerance. And the idea that, it's almost got turned on its head this week. People have said, well, you know, Gus Poyet, I thought he came out with some absurd stuff.
Yes.
He's sort of saying, you've got to understand, you've got to welcome people to your country and understand other cultures.
Has anything good come out of this? I mean, are we a bit better after this? Because I just feel like, you know, we've had racial abuse from crowds and stuff like that, and it's been discussed and whatever. But in terms of racial abuse between players, between fellow professionals, I just kind of looked at it as something that didn't really happen, not just in England, but around Europe. There are very, very few cases of it that you heard of. And now all of a sudden we've had these two cases. There was another case between Javi Garcia and Alan in Portugal. There was the allegation Luis Fabiano of Canute and Cesc in Spain, which that ended in a handshake and no charges. And then Blatter's comments, and I kind of feel like, how do we move past all this? And now it all comes back. Is this a good thing that this has all come up? Because it kind of maybe also reminds us of how vigilant we now are and how seriously we take it. Or is it maybe a sign that the tide is turning a little bit for the worse?
It certainly hasn't felt like a very good thing. It hasn't felt like it's very pleasurable to report on and comment on these past few weeks. But it's... I guess the only positive really is that, you know, it rids people of the idea that the battle has been won and that it's, you know, it's an ongoing battle, that there can be no room for complacency and that it has to be looked at constantly and you know, these anti-racism weekends or whatever in the Premier League, they have to be more than just lip service or more than a token issue of managers wearing badges on their lapels or whatever. But it's let's be honest, John Terry has not been charged, never mind found guilty yet. Suarez has not been found guilty, but there have been this spate of incidents. I mean, the other one that came to mind when you mentioned it, Gab, was the Busquets and Marcelo in the Champions League semi-final last season, and that got dealt with very quickly by, I can't remember, it was UEFA decided there was no case to answer. And I would think, after all of this, after the way that the FA are dealing with this and the police are dealing with it in the Terry case, I would think it at least would send out a message to the other football authorities in other countries and to UEFA and FIFA and everyone else that these issues have to be taken really seriously, because if you don't, if you just blindly sweep them under the carpet and in the hope that people, you know, forget about them, as was the case in Busquets, Marcelo, that you're basically allowing a situation to spread, aren't you?
Hey, how about some quick hits? I know Paddy's up for them. Arsenal win again, defeating Norwich 2-1, but Per Mertesacker makes headlines for the wrong reasons. Again. Paddy, is it time for Wenger to cut his losses? And what happens when Bakary Sagna returns and Koscielny takes his rightful place in the middle of the defence? Or does he?
Yeah, he does. I think on form, Koscielny and Vermaelen is a very good partnership. But what happens to Arsenal when Bakary Sagna returns? They improve. You can bet your life. And Mertesacker may have to fight his way back into the team. But he'll be a decent squad player despite his horrendous error on Saturday.
What I find so difficult to understand about Mertesacker is that he's made a lot of mistakes, but they're all different mistakes. Sometimes it's because he's not quick enough, sometimes it's because he's not strong enough, sometimes it's because his timing is wrong on his jump, sometimes he mishits the ball. It's remarkable. Such a great player making so many different kinds of mistakes. Manchester United win their fifth straight in all competitions, but they weren't exactly impressive against Swansea. Ollie, what does Sir Alex need to fix?
I think he needs to derail Manchester City somehow. I think that's his big concern at the moment. If Fergie, talking at the start of the season, was saying 84 points would be enough to win the league, and if you look at Man City at the moment, they look like they are going to defy any such prediction, and that City and that United will need to aim a lot higher to win the league. But I've always said that United's problems are in midfield. They don't really control games as they used to. They don't dominate, and they don't really excite. I'm sure they will pick up, but they're not really thrilling.
After spending big in the summer, Stoke crashed to their fourth straight defeat in the Premier League against QPR. But Ben, they were rather unlucky with some of those refereeing decisions. Are Stoke going to be okay, or is something wrong in Pulis land?
I think they were unlucky, Gab. I think the one thing that's wrong in Pulis land is the Europa League. I think they're having to deal with a new distraction, which they've done very well in. Their record post-Europa League is atrocious. And so hopefully over the Christmas period we'll see that settle down. But I don't think it's a problem per se.
I might add that for all the pulling of hair and gnashing of teeth, Stoke only have one fewer point at this stage than they did at this point last season. When asked about some of the dubious officiating against Stoke, the always humorous Neil Warnock joked, "I'm Arsene Wenger. I didn't see it." Tee-hee. Paddy, do you appreciate Warnock's humor? Are you slapping your knees? Or is his joke a little too retro, given that Wenger hasn't used that line in years?
That's a fair point, but I'm never going to criticize anybody, least of all Neil Warnock, for attempting a little bit of humor. It was fine. My word, retro or what?
Manchester City dispatched Newcastle 3-1, barely breaking a sweat. Ollie, can you spot a weakness in this City side right now?
I think the weakness is, I mean, if you look at the team last season, on paper it was brilliant, 1-11, or even 1-18, it was brilliant, and it didn't live up to that on the pitch or in the dressing room as a unit. But they seem to have corrected that this season. They seem to all be performing as a team and behaving as a team, apart from that little Argentinian guy whose name I've forgotten. And as long as they stay united with a small U, they'll be fine. But the unity is the one real doubt about them. I think personnel-wise, they're great.
It was Newcastle's first defeat of the season, and admittedly, Cheick Tiote wasn't available, which certainly didn't help. Ben, they have United and Chelsea next. Is this when the tune comes crashing back to earth?
Maybe. I think the fixture list has been very kind to Newcastle up till now. It's not very kind over the next month or so. But they weren't all that bad on Saturday. They had chances, and there are clearly more things right there than just confidence. So United and City, obviously very difficult games. Chelsea at home, I think they'll fancy their chances.
Chelsea at home at what stadium? St. James's Park! And nothing else.
Anyway, Gab, one for you. Borussia Dortmund started the season slowly in the Bundesliga, but wham! This weekend, they went to FC Bayern and won 1-0 with a goal from Mario Götze, the best young player I've seen for many, many years. So Borussia Dortmund, Jurgen Klopp's Borussia Dortmund, are they turning it around?
Yeah, so far so good. I mean, they lost three of their first six games of the season. A lot of people thought that they were going to struggle and get classic sort of second season syndrome. I mean, second season at the top, obviously. But, you know, Shaheen's gone. Gundogan's taking him a while to replace him. But what I find amazing about this team is how Klopp has sort of added this whole pragmatic element to it. Lewandowski compared to Barrios is much more movement-oriented, not as clinical a finisher, but certainly works much more for the team. I'll tell you what, one little facet of the game that I think sums up Klopp. They're away from home against Bayern. They're winning 1-0. They've moved within 2 points. Bayern have them under siege. They're chucking on forwards and wingers. They're pushing forward. Now, standard operating procedure at that point for a team is, hey, I'll take off an attacking player and I'll bring on an experienced defender or defensive midfielder, right? Well, what does Klopp do? He takes off Sebastian Kehl, his defensive midfielder, the oldest, most experienced player on the team, and he replaces him with this 18-year-old wunderkind, Moritz Leitner, who is sort of a box-to-box midfielder, runs around like a maniac, and it works. I love Klopp. Yeah. So counterintuitive. That's all we've got time for this week. But remember, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis. You can also follow us on Twitter. And there's also our web chats. Paddy's is on Mondays, mine is on Tuesdays, and Ollie K's on a Wednesday. Till next time, goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.